Of the young adult population defined as 18 to 25, only 6% of them are held within one of these three distinct young adult institutions. When we think about these young people who've got complex needs, vulnerabilities, likely to have experienced trauma previously, the experience of restraint generally, whether a child or an adult, can be re-traumatizing.
Hello, and welcome to Locked Up Living, the podcast which looks at resilience in challenging organisations, such as, but not only, prisons and hospitals for mentally ill prisoners and patients. My name is David Jones, and together with Naomi Murphy, I present your Locked Up Living podcast.
Jane Price joined the Department of Social and Political Science, Chest University, as a lecturer in criminology in September 2018. In October 2019, she completed her PhD at the University of Liverpool. The project was a case studentship with Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Prisons, funded by the Economic and Social Research Council. The research aimed to explore pathways and transitions between juvenile and adult penal institutions. Through speaking to young people who experienced the transition, key stakeholders, observations made within the institutions, alongside analysis of relevant literature and HMIP survey data, the research findings contribute to the ongoing collective reflexive learning of policy and practice. The original research sought to establish the most effective and progressive way of supporting young people through these transitions.
So, hi Jane, really good to meet you. Having read a couple of your papers today, they're really powerful and they made me feel both really sad and very angry in response. And I suppose what it really highlighted for me was the need for qualitative research, because kind of when you're reading the stats and the data, somehow the human impact of those stories doesn't come through, whereas looking at the qualitative stories that you were telling within those papers, I think perhaps in criminal justice more than any other sphere of life is so important in terms of showing the humanity of the people that you're talking about. So thank you. So today we're meeting to talk about your work, but can I begin by asking what brought you to this place in life? Why did you choose a career as a criminologist rather than, say, a psychologist or a psychiatrist or prison governor?
My interest was first sparked by, I remember it vividly, and it's something I always speak to students about when they start at the University of Chester. I ask them, you know, what's your interest in criminology? Because I really remember mine. And it was when I was in sixth form, we had some ex-offenders come along and speak to us for a day. And it merely made me reflect upon what presumptions and assumptions we make about these people in society and their position in society. And I just thought it was really interesting. It made me think I wanted to find out more and I wanted to do more for these individuals. And that links somewhat to what you were saying about the need for qualitative research and hearing the voices of those individuals, these who are frequently marginalised. It's really important that we try and promote their voices and help their experiences promote change for those that in future, so hopefully those don't have to experience as harsh circumstances as they have. So I was initially interested in studying psychology as well, but as I was studying, I just got more and more interested in criminology. And that's how I sort of then progressed into doing a master's and then into the PhD. And I really enjoy working in academia as well. I really enjoy seeing students learn and begin to understand things and develop their critical thinking and start asking questions. And that's something I'm really passionate about, which is why I'm really comfortable in academia. And it's also about seeking to engage within research as well. And as I say, hopefully inform policy and practice in a positive way.
Thank you. And you've mainly focused on younger people in your writing. Is there a particular reason for choosing to focus on that group?
So there's a lot of academic literature which focuses on the needs of young people, so those who are aged under 18 within the criminal justice system. there's a lot about how they're known to be vulnerable, the particular needs that this group have. And even though there is a growing awareness of that, we still know that these young people have a really detrimental experience within the criminal justice system, which is very harmful. It's a very difficult and challenging and complex environment to even begin to try and grow up in. And then where my interest has progressed to now is this idea of transitioning and becoming an adult within that criminal justice system, 10 and 18. We all know from our experiences that, you know, nothing magical happened on that night between 10 and 17 and 18. We didn't fundamentally change in any way, but we very much treat young people within the criminal justice system extremely differently at the point in which they turn 18 years. And so my interest has evolved to look at those young adults, because as I said, there's a wealth of literature on children and young people, and we need to continue, you know, arguing for better policies and better practice working with these young people to support their needs. But there's less so of a focus upon young adults. And when I say young adults, I mean those aged from age 18 up to 25. Sometimes, you know, some will argue that it extends further than that. But because many of the needs that young people have, why we consider them to be vulnerable within the criminal justice system under the age of 18, numerous vulnerabilities within that continue, and there's many more young people now who are making that transition through the criminal justice system. Those getting sent to prison, for example, are increasingly older, on longer sentences, and we have but half population making this transition. So actually we've got this distinct population, this distinct cohort within the criminal justice system that have got complex needs and need a distinct approach, but aren't really getting that attention. And I think it's really important to continue research in this area and to talk about the needs of this group so they do get the attention that they need and the support that they need as well.
One of the things that strikes me in the criminal justice system is how much black and white thinking is forced. And I suppose what's really striking about your area of study is actually you're choosing to focus on the grey ground that you know, rather than seeing a boundary as this strict cutoff, you're looking at the interface where two distinct areas are interwoven together, and there's actually a lot of grey within that, rather than, as you say, one minute being a child and the next minute being an adult. And that seems quite unusual in thinking about the criminal justice system. But I wondered what you regard as the special needs of this age group. You know, what have you found that highlights needs to be focused on, as opposed to the people that fall more clearly within the category of child or adult?
I think it's because we're so arbitrary about those categories. So you said about that boundary, and there's such a clear line drawn between child and adult, and the constructions of these groups are so blunt in institutions. So there's a lot of research evidence that actually, we know it anyway from our day-to-day lives, that actually these transitions to adulthood in any other way in society are extended and stretched. So, you know, young people don't necessarily go and enter their first and only job that they'll stay in forever at the age of 16 or 18. They'll stay in education much later and longer. People don't get married as young as they used to. People don't have children as young as they used to. So actually we have this extension of, you know, these what are seen to be sort of structural transitions into adulthood. We have this extension of them in society, but we have very arbitrary mechanisms of them within the criminal justice system. That's an extremely blunt expectation of, you're a child, so you're entitled to this support, you're entitled to stay in this institution, you're entitled to more staff, you have certain safeguards. You know, we have the United Nations Convention on the Rights of the Child. We have these things that are served to protect young children aged under 18 because they're seen as young children and vulnerable. But then at 18, they all just suddenly fall away, and we don't have that support for them because we have such arbitrary and blunt expectations of what a child is, what an adult is, and how they should be treated and how they are expected to behave and respond to the criminal justice system as well.
Yeah, and you referred there to the fact that as society, actually we do things at different times now than we did previously. Have there been any changes made to reflect that change, that bigger change that's there within society in terms of our expectations about what's on time and off time for people.
So in terms of the way we treat children and adults within society, do you mean?
Yeah. Well, no, in terms of how that happens in society, you're right, that is what happens in society now. We have different expectations. But has there been any changes in the justice system to accommodate those changes?
So for young adults within the criminal justice system. Mm. So there is, there's a growing body of literature about many of them, you know, with previous experience of trauma and vulnerability that we know exists within the youth justice system and the growing awareness of their maturity. So the government have sought to start to respond to this and have started to bring in predominantly the mechanism to respond is a maturity screening tool. And that's so they use maturity screening tools within prisons now. There's greater acknowledgement of maturity and its impacts within probation. So there is some recognition and Her Majesty's Prisons and Probation Service are seeking to work with stakeholder groups and look at best practice when working with young adults. So there's some initiatives, but looking at it, there's been a House of Commons inquiry into young adults, and Her Majesty's Inspector of Prisons have also released thematics talking about this as well. Whilst there is some pockets of things to support this, well, to recognise the distinct needs of this group, it doesn't often seem to be translated into a distinct approach or any distinct aspects of support. So there's this perception that, yes, we recognise that maturity is ongoing, but actually what does that mean for young adults? You know, staff working with young people aged under 18 will have specific training and more sort of trauma-informed training and much more in-depth training to work with this group. Those working with young adults, there's not mandatory training within the prison service. With the changes to the probation service, there's been some discussion about young adults, people trained to work with young adults. I'm trying to understand at the moment what that exactly is, what specific training that might be. So there's a greater recognition, and it seems like there's more motivation of late to support this group. But as I say, the inquiries that have taken place with the House of Commons Justice Committee, Her Majesty's Inspector of Prisons, doesn't seem that actually that translates into much support. And that was something that I found in my research as well, that there was guidance to sort of outline what should take place when young people make these transitions between institutions. And whilst there was a motivation to try and support these young people and prepare these young people, once they moved into the young adult estate, once you become a young adult, so much of this support falls away. So actually, as I said, there's some recognition, there's some changes, but actually I don't see that actually becoming a distinct approach for this population. Many of the experiences or many of the things that young adults have within the prison estate are subject to the same prison service orders and prison service instructions that apply to adults. So there doesn't seem to be much of a distinction there. And I think that's fundamentally where there's a real lack of support for this population.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because there's currently a move to introduce a bill in the House of Commons which will affect the age at which young people can be married. I think Sajid Javid was leading on that until he became the new health minister. Now it's been picked up by someone else. And so it seems that vulnerability and immaturity can be recognised in certain sections of society, but a blind eye is still turned elsewhere. And I was going to say maybe more towards young men than young women, but I think there are probably issues around incarcerated young women as well, which I think your paper doesn't actually cover. So I was just thinking of that while you were talking. But to move on, Jane, in your recent paper, which was the thing that caught our eye and made us keen to talk with you today. So in your paper, Violence, Control and Restraint, The Harms to Young Adults, Particularly Upon Transition, you begin by saying that only 6% of these young locked up men are in the specialist prisons, which are Aylesbury, Feltham and deer bolts. So can you explain to us why that is?
Yeah, so first of all, you're right. My research does look at young adult male. Well, I spoke to men when they were aged under 18 and aged over 18. There's a very small female population. And so these distinct young adult prisons were originally designated for those aged 18 to 21, because previously a young adult was defined for sentencing purposes as aged 18 to 20. And that's, as I say, why I create that distinction between young adults. There's a growing recognition that maturity is ongoing up to age 25. Just on women, so because there isn't these distinct young adult institutions, young women will transition, and there's no young offenders institutions for women aged between 15 and 18 as there are for males in the juvenile, in the youth custody estate. So young women make a very significant transition from a secure children's home or a secure training centre directly into an adult women's prison. It's a huge transition, very significant. There has been research, Pippa Goodfellow has done some research in that area, Transition to Adulthood Alliance, and there's a research project going on at the University of Lancaster at the moment, which is focusing on females as well. So there is some research which is considering the needs of young women. So with regards to my research and the point you make about the 6% of those being locked up in the specialist young adult prisons, that was a figure which was taken from Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Prisons thematic about young adults. And what that is of the young adult population defined as 18 to 25, only 6% of them are held within one of these three distinct young adult institutions. So they're held with a population aged 18 to 21 or in one institution 18 to 24. So actually what we have, part of what I've talked about in that paper and others is actually, other than the age of that population, I don't really see what is quite so distinct about those prisons, because they operate under the same prison service orders and instructions as adult prisons. Staff don't receive any difference in sort of mandatory training with regards to working with this population. So fundamentally what we have is we have groups of young adult, we only have 6% of the young adult aged 18 to 25 population in these distinct institutions, and the rest of them are held within the wider adult prison population. And what Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Prisons have found is that actually, you know, young adults frequently report having poorer outcomes and poorer experiences than older adults when they've done a comparator of the two different age populations. My research spoke to young people who'd made the transition, and some of them were held within distinct young adult prisons and some of them were held with older adult males. And there's a bit of a discussion about what is best for these groups. Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Prisons have said fundamentally it's a risk, but it needs to be judged on an individual basis and a maturity basis, because, for example, one young person I spoke to moved to a prison with all older adult males, and he felt that it was a much calmer population. He preferred to be with older adults. He felt that he could learn more from them. You know, these that had a significant amount of time in prison, giving him good advice in terms of, you don't want to end up like me, you know, you want to get out while you can. So he preferred that, but actually there's a real risk of mixing younger and older adult prisoners, because they could be vulnerable. It might be that they get preyed on. So as I said, HMIP have come to the conclusion that actually it needs to be on an individual basis. For me, what the real issue is that there's just not really a distinct strategy in place for this population, whether they're held within a young adult institution or whether they're held in an older adult male population. So younger adult males are said to be more volatile. So some people have argued that these distinct institutions are quite volatile, because we've got these, you know, younger groups, they sort of can rile each other up and that sort of thing. As I said, there's risks with them being with older ones. Fundamentally, what I think needs to be the case, there needs to be distinct strategy and support for this population, staff being trained suitably to work with this population, sufficient staff to attend to the needs of this population. So I think there's numerous issues where these young people are held. And just a final point on that, young adults who were put on remand will probably just be sent to a local prison, and so it might be that they actually may not end up being sent to a designated young adult institution, they'll just end up wherever's the most local prison. So we're not seeing placements taking place on individual needs. And that issue with regards to placements being based on individual needs is something that I saw an issue with within my own research. The point about young adults on remand, I think that's drawn from Rob Allen's work with Transition to Adulthood Alliance, who've also, and Leaders Unlocked, who've also been looking at some of these issues as well.
Thank you. So tell us what it's like being in one of these prisons. I've been to Aylesbury myself several times and Feltham many years ago. But try and get, can you give us a feel of what it's like?
I suppose my only experience is visiting for research and for interviews. And the accounts of the young people that I interviewed really was that it was a very challenging environment in which to grow up in. You know, especially those making the transition as well, they really wanted to move away from any notion of being vulnerable. So in the juvenile prison, a youth prison for those aged under 18, they had a sense of they wanted to move on. They were sick of being stuck with kids. They felt like they were bothered all the time by staff. But then when they moved, they felt that there wasn't any staff. There wasn't any support mechanisms in place for them. They didn't have any consistency of staff members. They didn't know who they were speaking to and seeing day to day. They didn't know who they could just go and ask for help. Some of the young people talked about, you know, individuals on their wing being scared and staying in their room all the time because they just didn't want to leave because of their fears about being within the institution. Many of them talked about violence. You know, there's much academic literature which talks about violence just being a part and parcel, everyday aspects of prison life. And I think, you know, it's commonly known, but it shouldn't be, you know, it shouldn't be the case that this is what these individuals are subject to and what they're trying to grow up in and try and negotiate and navigate. It's such a, as I say, it's a very challenging environment to try and grow up in and form your sense of identity within as well.
Also, just thinking about the impact on your brain as it's still developing, if you're living with this kind of like in this culture of fear for prolonged periods, that has to have an impact on how your brain's been shaped.
Yeah, absolutely. So much, you know, much literature about prisons is about, you know, individuals becoming institutionalised, and it is. I think it's Kate Gooch talks about, you know, it's a crucial part of identity formation this time. As you say, you know, your brain is developing, you're trying to mature, but actually how can you mature in that environment where this is all you know? And actually there's an expectation that, as I said, you know, as soon as you turn 18, you're suddenly expected to be much more autonomous, but you're in an environment where you've got no autonomy, no opportunity to make decisions about your life. So young people in the juvenile would maybe feel like they didn't have any control over their circumstances, and, you know, almost that they were sort of like mollycoddled and they really wanted to grow up and move to an adult institution. But then when they did, and they just felt like, I haven't got any support, I don't have anything to try and... And this is this point again about these, you know, these maturity screening tools as well. It's something that Coyle and Brewster have both talked about, actually. Much of these judgments of maturity are assessed looking at a sort of the lack of maturity that individuals have, rather, and once again going back to the inquiries that have taken place, actually, but what becomes after that, what is there to try and support these young people to help them mature, help them develop and move them towards more positive outcomes in their life.
Thank you. In your paper you focus quite a bit upon restraints. So what are the issues around that?
So there's been a lot of controversy about restraint generally. So Article 39 is charity has focused on this quite a lot. There was two deaths of children under restraint, and it led to an inquiry, and that led to a response, which was the minimising and managing physical restraint. So it led to a change in the way in which restraint was enacted within the youth custodial estate. This is one of the biggest changes, I think, that has been very much overlooked in transitions guidance. This is one of the biggest changes I think young people experience upon making that transition within prison. Because it goes from minimising and managing physical restraints to control and restraint. So even the language there, we can see how these different groups, these children versus adults, are treated and how they're sought to be sort of controlled, managed, regulated in this environment. So what happens is in the youth custodial estate, it's about trying to sort of young people understand and having conversations with young people, trying to sort of diffuse the situation before a restraint is enacted. It's said to be one of last resort, although evidence indicates that it's not a last resort in which when restraint is used. So it's about sort of trying to de-escalate these incidents, and the way in which staff members will restrain young people is different, acknowledged because of the different physicality of children to an adult. In the adult estate, and as I said, there's no distinction here between young adults and adults. In the adult estate, as soon as you turn 18, you're subject to control and restraint. But you could be days in difference in age. And that's where I think there's a real challenge in terms of, you know, this transition. I think it's one of the most harmful changes within a transition. So where previously staff couldn't carry batons, they can in the adult estate. Where previously staff couldn't carry incapacitant spray, they can in the adult estate. Again, these things are meant to be used as a last resort. There's meant to be some focus on de-escalation. But, you know, the evidence from Her Majesty's Inspectorate, who looked at restraint generally within the adult estate, and speaking to some of the individuals that I interviewed, I spoke to young people, I also spoke to staff, was that actually, you know, restraint does get enacted on people, and for young people especially who make this transition, this is a big change and they're not expecting it. And I spoke to one person, and I think the quote is in the paper, that they restrained someone in the young adult estate. And this young adult who's moved from the child estate, and this young adult said, "You're assaulting me." And the staff member was like, "No, I had to explain, that's how we restrain. And that gives you a very slight insight into what that experience of being under restraint must be like. But when we think about these young people who've got complex needs, vulnerabilities, likely to have experienced trauma previously, the experience of restraint generally, whether a child or an adult, can be re-traumatising. You know, it's a physical act that can be harmful to young people. And once again, I say, you know, it's these judgments based on child and adult, judged on the physicality of those individuals. You can't have a child who is 6 foot and doesn't look like he's 17. You can also have an 18-year-old who could be 5 foot something and doesn't look like they're 18. You know, so, but once again, going back to these arbitrary expectations of how we should treat children and adults leads to these extremely different practices in restraint. And I'm not saying that the restraint used within the youth estate is okay, but I'm saying there's much more focus on these being children and the way in which they should be responded to than there is in the action of control and restraint.
Thank you. Yeah, I can see that's a really important issue. So moving on, you and you've begun to touch upon this already, I think, because in your paper you mention adverse childhood experiences, ACEs, as being a particular issue for this population. So I wonder if you could tell us why and what you mean by that.
Yeah, so they're adverse childhood experiences. So this can be being a victim of trauma, abuse, violence, numerous different aspects that could heavily and negatively impact upon your life. I think within the paper I make reference to a couple of authors that have talked about this in more detail. And so the Prison Reform Trust is one example who've discussed it. And this has a number of implications on, you know, health, well-being. And it's often these individuals that are drawn into the criminal justice system. We know that those involved in the criminal justice system are likely to have had challenging and complex backgrounds. And has numerous implications, as I say, on their lives and their futures. One of which is issues in terms of how they develop relationships. And they might have issues developing trust in relationships. For young people who've experienced that, they might struggle in the way in which they seek to engage or disengage with adults. And so we can see how this has fundamental implications on those that transition. Firstly, because there's a distinct reduction in staffing between the youth estate and the young adult and adult estate. So there's a lot less staff, there's much less ability for them to develop these, any sort of sense of support and relationship. But also, as I say, these issues of restraint can be re-traumatising for these individuals who may have experienced trauma and violence previously. And this is also the differences in sort of staffing and establishing relationships. This exists within the prison estate, but also with regards to probation as well. So I've written a paper about that, and the fact that within, for young people aged under 18, youth offending teams have and workers with a young person on their caseload have to make contacts with these individuals every 3 months. And it was a less sort of predefined requisite in the probation service. As I say, the probation service and its remodelling this week, you know, there seems to be more focus on young adults. But from what I can gather, there isn't any greater obligation to have more contact with young people. So for young people that transition, actually, they have less staff within these institutions and less staff and less contact with other supportive services they might be engaged in. So that's a real fundamental issue there, in terms of, as I say, the relationships that they form. But also, as I say, they're frequently victims of trauma, abuse, violence and other complex and challenging circumstances. And that obviously will impact upon their experience within institutions, especially if they're held in an institution when they sort of have to learn that violence is the way in which you respond, or violence is the way in which you have to get attention. You know, so there's numerous implications for these individuals. And I think, as I say, there's some acknowledgement of it within that children have these vulnerabilities, but less so that these vulnerabilities continue to extend to young adults.
Strikes me, Jane, that your research really kind of like highlights the question of, for want of a better word, the morality of keeping people in prisons as we know them, because actually many of the things you're talking about, I think, also actually apply to adults in the true sense of the word of adult as well, in terms of histories of abuse and then being restrained, for instance. But I think it becomes much more stark when you're focused on that younger population, where you can really see that. But I think, you know, your research really does highlight the significant question about what we do to such a large group of society, you know, 90,000 people.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting as well, because you say, you know, thinking about it extending to adults as well. When I say we can define young adults as up to age 25, we need to be really cautious as well, because actually all we could potentially do is just extend an arbitrary measure to 25, or say, oh no, it's up to 30. You know, actually, as you say, a number of these actual vulnerabilities exist for all those within the criminal justice system. We know that those who are within it are frequently those that have got mental health conditions, previously been excluded from school, can have physical health problems as well, might have substance misuse issues, are likely to be drawn from challenging circumstances. Many of them have probably grown up within the criminal justice system as well. So a lot of those vulnerabilities do extend throughout the criminal justice system population. And so we do need to be quite cautious, as I say, about, you know, where we sort of put that level of support. I would argue, you know, we need to be putting much more support and much more provision in to try and help individuals have better outcomes within the criminal justice system, because we know fundamentally it's harmful, there's a revolving door, we're not helping these individuals address any of the issues that are affecting their well-being and that are affecting their offending behaviour. But I think that's going back to one of the questions you asked before. That's why I'm really focused at the moment on young adults, because I think they're very much a population that are overlooked, and they've got a distinct needs that actually really, really needs attention and need to be addressed, but currently aren't being.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So in your paper, you mentioned you were a young woman working in a prison with young men deprived of female company. What was that experience like for you? What were the implications of that?
So I reflect on my research, because as a researcher, you inevitably operate from a powerful position to those that you interview. And for those that are children and prisoners, they're also have got a sort of subordinate relationship to you as well. And that's something that I really wanted to try and overcome. And I really wanted to ensure that I really had their best interests at heart, and I wanted to hear their perspectives and I wanted to make their voices heard. But actually, for a young person who was maybe 10 or so years younger than me, potentially of a different ethnicity to me, of a different gender to me, how would they see that I could understand their experiences? How could they feel that I could really identify with what they'd gone through? And I say, there was nothing I could do to try and overcome those dynamics, but I did say to people, you know, no, I really want to hear your perspective. And I had like an occasion where I was asking people, I would interview them and go like, what's your perspective? What do you think? And they'd be like, oh, what I say doesn't matter anyway. And it was really important to me to say, you know, it really is. This is why I'm doing this research. I want to try and make this better for individuals that will go through this transition in future. So your view is really important. But for that young person, it was a case of, well, no one listens to me here. So what's the point? Why bother? Why should I tell you? And I said, those characteristics that make it quite different. For the young men that I interviewed, you know, they are trying to negotiate their identity, their transition to adulthood within this environment. And, you know, this construction of their status, being told they're a child and then being told they're an adult. And so it's how they're trying to navigate that at the time. So in those institutions, you do not want to be seen as vulnerable. You want to do everything you can to move yourself away from that sense of being vulnerable. So actually, the fact that I was a female may have been a way in which they wanted to try and perform their masculinity and wouldn't want to admit to me, I feel vulnerable, I feel scared. Because I'd ask them that, I would say, do you feel scared? And not many of them would say yes. But then some of the things that I would talk to them about, there was a sense of fear. You could hear that they were concerned about those transitions. And so there was one young person that I interviewed, and he was, you know, really wanted to sort of be like, well, I'm not worried, I'm not scared, it's fine. And to try and speak to him about his experience and understand how he felt about it, rather than ask him directly, I would say, you know, how do you think young people feel? So I would take away the personal aspect from it and would say, okay, well, young people that are going through this, what do you think, how do you think they feel about it? And he said something like, well, I, you know, it doesn't bother me, but I know that there's young people who will be really worried about it. So he would convey in a different way that actually he was concerned about his upcoming transition.
Thank you. And I think your paper was part of a wider research project that you've been doing. Would you like to say a few words about that?
Yeah, so what the research project was looking at was, I wanted to understand the pathways and experiences that young people would experience when moving from the juvenile secure estate or the youth custodial estate into the young adult and adult estate. So I spoke to 14 young people when they were aged 17 years and a few months before they transitioned, and then when they were 18 years plus, so in a few months, and they made the transition. So we interviewed them at two different stages. And then interviewed staff members who were called key stakeholders. So there was insider and outsider stakeholders. There was 22 in total. And some worked within the institutions. Others were experts who were inspectors, lawyers, charity workers, other academics, to hear about, you know, anyone who had a sort of vested interest in this area. So we interviewed them. The research was funded by the Economic and Social Research Council. I also was supported with an in-kind contribution from Her Majesty's Inspector of Prisons, and they gave me access to their data from a period between 2014 and 2017. So I had some aspects of that quantitative data that you were talking about before, and also some of the qualitative data drawn from survey comments. And I also looked at the wider literature concerned with this area. So I wanted to understand what that experience was like for those that would transition, and sort of their expectations of it before, and then what their actual experience was like after, and then surrounding that, hear about what stakeholders' perceptions of it were and a broader experiences of it. Because I wanted to capture, as you say, that the qualitative insights were really important to really understand the views of the young people and sort of have that in-depth before and after, but then also capture a broader range of perspectives from those that may have witnessed more, may have witnessed them at different times, and see how that situation evolved. And so what I found is that there was an inquiry in the House Commons Justice Committee before this, and Royal College of Psychiatrists said these transitions were frequently abrupt and inadequately planned. And that was very much what I found. Before transition, the young people had some sense of what was going on, but not many of them really knew where they were going to go or when they were going to go. And their expectation was they would be told on the day and then they would go. And that was the reality. There was a knock on the door, they were thrown some bags and told you're going today. And for some of them, that was on their 18th birthday. And so they transferred, maybe didn't get much of a chance to say goodbye to people, maybe even half completed some education work. And then they moved into this institution which had much less support. You know, they're not entitled to the sort of child protection things they were before. They weren't entitled to as many safeguards. And thresholds for services change as well. So they're suddenly treated extremely differently, but very little has happened for them. And it's been such a blunt shift and change. Like we've talked before about, you know, broader transitions within society. I speak to some university students about it and say, you know, you got to come to an open day, you got to go to a few different open days, you got to come with your mum and dad or your carer or your friend, and you got to go, oh, I like this about this one, I didn't like this about this one. These young people making this transition get a knock on the door, go and wait in a holding cell, go in a van, and for some the door opens on the van and that's when they know where they're going. So they don't have much, you know, this information. And as I say, as I've talked about before, you know, frequently felt like there was much less support for them and not quite sure who they could turn to. The staff members that I spoke to, you know, there was many of them that were really working hard in very challenging circumstances. It's not to undermine the work that many of them do. And many institutions, staff I spoke to in institutions and staff members I've spoke to in institutions following this when I've presented the research to them, many of them have got real great intentions to support these young people, to try and prepare these young people within the parameters of what they can do. One of the arguments for not telling young people where they're going to is based on this, based on security reasons, that if they're told, then that's a security risk to the institution if they're told when they're going and where they're going. So that was one of the reasons why young people can't be told. But what this can actually lead to is a cycle of quite detrimental behaviour, because for young people maturing and developing, this frustration can manifest itself in a different way. They can start kicking off, they can start be challenging. And that can lead to something which was called discipline transfers, where young people are literally not even told they're going to be moved. They're bundled into a van and moved because of their behaviour. So there's numerous issues that result out of these transitions as well. In the young adult estate, many staff members were talking about, you know, actually we don't have the resource to support these young people. I'd love to spend time and get to know these young people and be there for them as much as I can, but there's not as much resource for me to do this. I've got to work this wing of so many people. So, as I say, there was many staff members that were working hard in these circumstances, but actually the resource wasn't there to provide for these individuals. And I found a real gap between the policy and the practice, what was taking place. And then some of the staff members that I spoke, some of the stakeholders that I spoke to outside of institutions, you know, sort of echoed some of the findings in terms of being arbitrary, in terms of the vulnerability of these young people and the requirement for, you know, distinct support for this group. I know that there's a new policy framework forthcoming that seeks to sort of better address these issues. But as I say, there needs to be, I think, a great investment in the young adult estate fundamentally to try and support this population.
And did you include, Jane, and you know, the children that their behaviour is so aggressive that they get moved into the adult estate prematurely? Did your research include any of those individuals?
There was not for their transition. There was one young person who had experienced one of those types of transitions previously, but not as part of their transition when they were 10 and 18.
Yeah, it's just it's really heartbreaking to hear about your research, to be honest, because I think you see 17-year-olds going off to sixth form and what have you, and they look so young, don't they? They just look like kids, and to hear these stories are actually very painful.
Yeah, that's a very powerful message you've got to present, Jane. So I hope it makes an impact. You've reminded me of something when you were talking about your experiences in these young persons' establishments. It reminded me of when I was doing my training as a social worker. So this was many years ago, and I spent a month at Hunter Coombe Borstal, which I think is now closed, probably. It was a funny sort of placement. I didn't really know what to do. And I don't remember very much about it, except that I do remember being sent to sit in a cell with one young man to talk about him and what he'd done and why he was there. And I remember hardly anything about that, apart from the fact that he said to me, "I know people on the out. I know people with guns. I could get one of them to come and shoot you." So I remember that very clearly, and of course in retrospect I can see that as being, you know, an expression of a young man who had very little power in his position, no leverage over his situation at all, who was meeting somebody who spoke like me, who was more or less the same age as he was, and it then becomes, you know, I didn't understand at the time, becomes a totally understandable response. So anyway,
it does, and I think it goes back to what we're talking about. It's sort of, you know, it's the experience of growing up in these institutions, an experience of growing up somewhere where it's violent, you know, where, you know, you're trying to mature and develop and learn how to express yourself, but in an environment which has these expectations that you're not vulnerable and that you can stand, you know, that you can stand on your own 2 feet and defend yourself. And so it leads these young people to react in this way. And as I talked about before as well, you know, sometimes young people will act in a certain way because they need to, it's their way of sort of saying, "I need support, I need attention, but I don't know how else to sort of express it." And so it will or manifest itself in many different ways. And until we actually acknowledge that and try and address the things that these individuals need, we're going to continue with that, and we're going to continue these young people having this cycle of being within these institutions and the harms inflicted on them within these institutions. And linking back to that the paper with regards to restraints, you know, that's essentially what we're telling people, that actually that's how you respond to people is with violence, because that's what the institution is inflicting upon them. So there's numerous harms being within the criminal justice system. And as I say, I think the restraint and the differences in restraint practices is one of the most fundamental ones that is overlooked hugely upon this transition.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much indeed. So, Jane, this is difficult work, and you must have spent many hours immersed in the detail of difficult and painful events, and you've been describing some of those to us today. How do you keep yourself in balance? Is there any particular activity, any music or a book? How do you keep yourself sane?
I think, you know, we're lucky because this is not my day-to-day life. I'm not in that institution, and you do sometimes think about those individuals. And like, one of the things I talked about, well, one of the things I reflected on when I was leaving was actually how you leave as well. Like, I was so conscious, like after the first interview with young people, I was like, okay, well, I'll see you know, in a few months, and we can talk about what it was like and stuff. And then you had that second interview, and I just remember really feeling like, how do I close this interview? How do I end it and just say, okay, you know, I might have had to wait for someone to let me out of the prison that day, but actually, you know, these young people have got however many years left. Or, you know, I was so, so aware of that when I went, and I'm so conscious that, like, the reality for some of these young people is really harsh. And I think that is one of the things that anyone who's involved in social justice in any way will really focus on. It's how do we make the outcomes for these individuals better? How do we help these individuals? So I think that is your focus. It's that focus on helping these young people. It's something you'll both probably be working towards as well. Personally, I don't know if, well, I think I know a lot of people, and I'm one of them, who've just become a lockdown walker. People with their daily walks, it's just become like a bit of a rite of passage now, hasn't it? So I've tended to sort of, you know, and respect a bit more where I live, and luckily I'm not too far from walks where we can walk along the sea. So I tend to do that, and sometimes just walk without listening to anything, but other times we'll, yeah, listen to podcasts and stuff. So I think it's great that you've brought this new one, for something else for people to listen to, because I think it's, you know, you can select a podcast from a different area. You can have one where you think, I want to hear about someone's experience, I want to listen to an interview, or I want to listen to something just silly, or I want to listen to something that's about one of my passions. So that's what I tend to do. I tend to go for a walk and listen to a podcast.
Brilliant. Well, thanks very much indeed, Jane. Thanks for giving us your time today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I really appreciate it. It's been really interesting speaking to you.
So one of the reasons I enjoy doing these conversations with you, Naomi, is because we cover such a broad spectrum. So, you know, one week we can be talking to someone about a historical criminal justice setting, and we're putting that on record, which is, I think, terribly valuable. And then, like today, when we're talking with Jane, we're talking to somebody who's applied her focus to a fresh area of work, really, and it's this kind of complex interface between a young person growing up, in age at any rate, in the number of days and years, and becoming an adult, and what that transition means. And I think it's so important that we have people like Jane who are doing this kind of research, because clearly the way that we manage that at the moment isn't really very helpful.
Yeah, I found what Jane had to say very, very powerful, actually, and profoundly so. And it also reminded me of my very first job within the prison service, was within a young offenders institute. And of course, I was only 22, so I wasn't that much older, but actually looking, you know, back on that population now, much, you know, 30 years on from that, you know, has a different kind of meaning, and as the mother of a boy as well, it has a very different meaning for me. But I thought it was another very powerful conversation, so I really enjoyed that opportunity to think with Jane about work she does, which I think is really, really important. But equally, it's quite painful sometimes to hear these stories. Mm.
Many thanks again to all of you who have listened to our Locked Up Living podcast. Feel free to mention this to your friends and to your colleagues, and give us feedback on our webpage, lockeduplives.com, and our Twitter account, Locked Up Living. Many thanks to Pete and Rach, who kindly allowed us to use their music, You Have Called Me Courage, and this is available from all the usual outlets.